This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you watch Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, you know what an uncanny ability he has to do other people's voices, like Neil Young and Bob Dylan. Lots of people who can't stay up late enough to watch the show see his impressions because they go viral on the internet. Jimmy Fallon became known for his impressions when he was a cast member on Saturday Night Live, but he became even better known on SNL for co-anchoring Weekend Update with Tina Fey. Fallon took over Late Night from Conan O'Brien when O'Brien left to prepare to host The Tonight Show in 2009. Every Friday on Late Night, Fallon does a feature called Thank You Notes, in which he writes and reads messages addressed to the things that have made him grateful during the week. I spoke with him last May after he published his book collecting those thank you notes. Jimmy Fallon, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you on the show.
I'm a big fan. Thank you so much for having me on.
So let's start with some thank you notes. And we have your theme music, your thank you note theme music. So you have some picked out, so here we go.
Yeah, I'm getting ready. Here we go. Let's just start it off. Thank you, the word moist, for being the worst word ever. I think I speak for all Americans when I say we don't want you as a word anymore. God, I hate you. Thank you, hard taco shells, for surviving the long journey from factory to supermarket to my plate, and then breaking the moment I put something inside you. Thank you. Thank you, yard sales, for being the perfect way to say to your neighbors, we think we're important enough to charge money for our garbage. Thank you, the name Lloyd, for starting with two L's. I'm glad both those L's were there, because otherwise I would have just called you Lloyd. And finally, thank you, slow-walking family walking in front of me on the sidewalk. No, please take your time. And definitely spread out, too, so you create a barricade of idiots. I am so thankful that you forced me to walk on the street and risk getting hit by a car in order to pass you so I could resume walking at a normal human pace. Thank you.
I love that. That's Jimmy Fallon from his new book, Thank You Notes. And Jimmy, you know, sometimes Friday nights, the last thing I hear before going to sleep is your thank you notes.
That's all I can ask for. I love that. That's all I want.
So do you make mental notes all week about things that bother you that you can use for the thank you notes?
Yeah. Like if something just happens, like the other day something happened, I bought a pack of gum and the receipt, I'm not kidding, was over a foot long. It might have been 2 feet long of receipt paper. And I'm walking and you could hear me as I'm walking around the store with this receipt. I go, I bought a pack of gum. This is insane. This is, you're killing the rainforest for my orbits. And there was like coupons on the back. I go, this has just reached a level of insanity. So I'm sure there'll be a thank you note for that. You know, but the other day we were laughing at, you ever go down the hallway at work and there's someone walking at the same speed as you and right next to you? So we're almost like walking together and I don't know who they are. It's like, should we hold hands? Like, what do we, are you going to slow down? Do I speed up? How does this work? Like, what is going on? One of us has to make a decision here. So those types of things, like, you know, they're just random, but you go, oh, yeah, there should be a joke somewhere about this.
Okay, you had to learn how to do interviews.
tell me with this, Terry, because let's talk about doing interviews.
What did you have to learn to do it, and how hard do you think it is?
Holy moly.
As an interviewer, I really want to hear you talk about this.
It's hard. I think probably the best advice you can give somebody who's getting into it is, you won't learn how to do it until you do it. Because I was trying to practice. I mean, I would sit to the left of my wife every night at dinner and look at her and try to ask her about her food and stuff. But, I mean, you don't really know what it's like until you're actually in the situation and talking to people and just letting the conversation flow.
So you didn't do it at all until you were doing it on the air?
Yeah. I didn't know what to do. I mean, interview strangers. I interviewed my mom. I mean, what do? I mean, I don't know who else to interview. So, I mean, you know what? The best practice I had, but it's true. I mean, I don't know how
was
to do this.
Was she a good guest? Would she be good?
She was awful guest. She was an awful guest. She kept wanting to cut to a clip, and we have no clip. She's not in a movie. She's my mother.
One of the things I love about your show is it gives you an opportunity to do your music impressions. You're amazing when it comes to doing the music impressions of people like Neil Young and Bob Dylan. So let's just hear an example of it first. So this is you doing the Willow Smith song,
Willow
Whip
Smith,
My Hair.
Yeah.
And she's the daughter of Will Smith and Jada Pinkett.
Yeah, she's
Smith.
A very good hip-hop song. Goes, I whip my hair back and forth. I whip my hair back and forth. Yeah. It's a big hit song. So this is me doing Neil Young doing Whip My Hair with Bruce Springsteen.
Okay, so here it is. So that's Jimmy Fallon doing Neil Young. We didn't have time here for the Springsteen part. Maybe we'll get to that a little later. But so what's so interesting about how you do this is you're not only doing Neil Young's voice, you're rewriting the song the way Neil Young would sing it because he's such an idiosyncratic singer in terms of the way he re-melodicizes things. So can you talk about like doing Neil Young?
Yeah. I always kind of had a Neil Young impression, like everyone does, you know. But
I
a great
don't.
Writer.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. You must have sang along with a few songs. I've heard you do Harvest Moon. So I've always just had it as an impressionist. I think every impressionist has a Neil Young, let's just say that. But you never know what to do with it. You know, once you have it, it's like having a Jack Nicholson impression. Everyone's got one. What do you do with it? There's a great writer. This is just a tip of the hat to my writing staff. A writer said, why don't you do a version of Neil Young? We'll do a nice version of Willow Smith's Whip My Hair. And I go, oh, that's funny. That'd be cool. I go, also, Bruce Springsteen's coming on. Would you think he would do a duet with me if we wrote a fake duet with me as fake Neil Young and him really as him? He goes, well, let's get to it. So we sat down. We had a guitar. He had a guitar. And we just sat around my office, and I'm trying to think of, like, how Neil would do it. And it's a lot of G chord into D chords and maybe throw in, like, an A minor in there. And it's like whip my hair back and forth. Just whip it. You know, and they get the harmonica going, the harmonica thing around the neck. And then I go, and Bruce has got to come in. He's got to go, like, you got to whip your hair. Whip my hair back and forth. You got to whip your hair. You know, he's got to jump in with that energy. And now I go, and so we recorded it on our phone, you know, with just a scratch recording of me and him. And we're laughing, and we record the thing, and we send it over to Bruce Springsteen's manager. And his manager gets it, and he goes, Bruce loves it. He thinks it's hilarious. His kids know Whip My Hair. And so, and he's seen you do Neil Young on the show, and he's game. He goes, here's our idea. Do you want Bruce to dress like young Bruce from the 70s? So I right out my jaws, I'm like, of course, yeah. I didn't even think that he would even put on when are you going to get Bruce Springsteen in a wig? I'm telling you right now, it'll never
happen. And a fake mustache and beard.
Yeah, and a fake beard. And, I mean, this is from the Born to Run era, you know, floppy hat. This is cover of Newsweek and Time Magazine Bruce Springsteen, where you go, whoa, this is the future of rock and roll Bruce Springsteen. So the fact that he's game for this, I go, okay, we'll get a beard and we'll get a floppy hat. I go, no problem. He goes, and Bruce said he's going to bring his sunglasses from the Born to Run tour.
That's so great.
Actual mirrored sunglasses. I go, okay, he's game. So he comes over. We have great hair and makeup girls, Cindy Lou and Courtney are in there. They put he brings his sunglasses out. They tape a beard on him because they want to put glue on his face. And he goes, you got the floppy hat? And we put the floppy hat on him. He goes, whoa, this looks exactly like it. This is great. I go. Well, also, we have a wig. Do you want to try the wig on? He goes, what? No. Wait, what are you trying to do to me? No, I don't want to wear a wig. I go, okay, no problem. No big deal. So everyone leaves the room. It's just me and Bruce. We're kind of laughing. And I the door's closed, and I go, hey, it's just us. You want to just try the wig on? He's like, what? I go, just try the wig. I mean, it's got the curls on it. I think it'll be the final touch. He goes, all right, hurry up, put the wig on. So I put a wig on Bruce Springsteen, and I'm putting this wig on him, and he's laughing. And then we put the floppy hat and the beard and the glasses, and he looks at the mirror, and he goes, whoa! And that was it.
And then to top it all off, Springsteen throws in a little Thunder Road thing toward the end. So why don't we hear the part where Bruce Springsteen comes in and joins you as Neil Young.
Cool.
So that's such a great moment. Were there Neil Young records you just steeped yourself in before doing that? Do you listen to a lot of the performer you're going to do before you do them?
Yeah, I think I have one of those things. When I grew up, I had, you know, I've always done impressions. So I think if I listen to a record long enough, so I'll listen to Harvest, and I'll listen to the whole album, and then I could do Neil Young. I can listen to, you know, Blonde on Blonde, you know, and I'll do Bob Dylan. You know, I could watch an episode of Jerry Seinfeld, and by the end, I'm just walking around my house. You know, I'm talking like Jerry Seinfeld. What is that? What are you doing? Who is there? What's going on? You know, I just had that thing when I grew up. I just start talking like people. I always had that. I would go visit a friend of mine's house, and I come back. And my mom was like, "You're talking like Joey Gonzalez," because I would sound like my best friend. I would just imitate him, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jimmy Fallon, the host of Late Night, and he has a new book called Thank You Notes, and it's the thank you notes from his regular hilarious Friday night feature.
Thank you, Terry. Terry, did you ever have a different voice when you were starting in radio?
Yes.
What was your other voice? Was it wackier?
It wasn't wacky. It was just kind of more like this. When I get nervous, my voice, anyways, this used to be the case. When I'd get nervous, my voice would rise approximately an octave, and and I'd speak like really super fast. So when I started hosting on a college station, I was hosting like a feminist radio show, but I was talking kind of like this. So I always thought I sounded kind of like a feminist Minnie Mouse.
That is great, because I always loved. I'm obsessed with radio. I love radio so much. And I, as a comedian, I used to have to do radio like morning zoo crew shows at like 7 a.m.
As a guest. Yeah. Okay.
Just so I can plug the tickets to, so they can sell a comedy show. You know, I was doing comedy clubs when I was like, you know, 18 and 19. So I'd have to sell them out, and I'd have to go on radio shows. I'm like, good morning. We're here with Jimmy Fallon on the air, and Jimmy, I mean, you know. Let me tell you something. Saturday Night Live isn't funny anymore. Our weatherman hates your guts. He's like, yeah, I don't like you, Jimmy Fallon. You know, and I have to get in fights at 7 a.m. You know, it's like, and they try to be shocking. They're like,
so anyway, I was getting my prostate checked the other day. It's 7:15 in the a.m.
And I go, you got to be kidding me. Who wants to hear about this guy? And they're the nicest to you off the air. They're like, hey, Jimmy, thanks for being here at the Z103. You're the greatest. Saturday Night Live couldn't be funnier. Thank you so much. Are you ready to be on the air? I go, I'm ready to be on the air. I was like, perfect. Here we go. We're going to be on the air in 2 seconds. Okay.
And we're back. Jimmy Fallon here. He's on Saturday Night Dead. That's what I call it, because it hasn't been funny in 15 years.
You know, and it's like, I go, you just told me over the commercial break that you liked it.
Is that what you'd actually say?
No. I would actually try to defend the show stupidly, because I wasn't old enough to figure out that this is all a game. You know, it's just like, okay, he's just trying to rattle me so that he can get a good quote out of me.
Now, I read that the first imitation you did was James Cagney, and I thought that's crazy, because when I was growing up, and I'm older than you are, all the impressionists did Cagney, you dirty rat. And
yes.
That was like during the Ed Sullivan era. You didn't grow up
Frank
during
Gorshin, yeah.
Yeah, you didn't grow up during that era. You grew up during the Saturday Night Live era, when people were no longer doing James Cagney. So how did you end up doing Cagney impressions?
It's more of a technicality. I did it. I was 2 years old when I did that impression, so I was a baby. And my mom would say, "Jimmy, do James Cagney," and I would go, "You dirty rat." So I already had an act.
How did you
I already
hear
had
it?
An act at 2 years old.
How did and then you know I did, about I think I did, Jimmy Cagney then?
I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, and I think they force you to watch every James Cagney movie. I mean, come on, kids,
Yankee,
come on in.
Yankee Doodle Dandy, too?
Oh, of course, Song and Dance. That's the advanced years of Cagney. Yeah, but you start off with the gangster movies. I mean, every kid loves a good gangster movie.
Oh, who doesn't?
But, I mean, I watched, yeah, Angels with Dirty Faces, White Heat. I've seen all of it. My favorite movie of all time, by the way, is City for Conquest.
Oh, I haven't it's kind seen of, that.
It is such a good movie. He goes blind in the ring. His girlfriend is a dancer on Broadway. She becomes famous. He goes blind, and then he's a newsie. He's selling newspapers, and he smells her perfume. Oh, it's heartbreaking. It is a great movie.
Do you ever get into trouble with celebrities who you're imitating? Do they ever not like it and not take it as a compliment?
You think they would? I just saw recently. I did a Donald Trump impression, and I saw Donald Trump, and it was. My impression was basically because I was thinking the president got and announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed, he announced it right in he interrupted the last 15 minutes of The Celebrity Apprentice. And I go, man, this is perfect, right? I mean, that's a double win for Obama. So I said, we got to do Trump. I got to do some press conference where he's like, this is amazing, a beautiful, beautiful evening, the president. You know, it's like, did you really have to interrupt the last 15 minutes of one of the greatest boardrooms in the history of Celebrity Apprentice? Beautiful people there, fantastic job. And I say, like, I mean, why couldn't you have waited till the show that's on after me, which is, let's see what it is. Let's see what's on after me. Oh, yeah, the news. Why couldn't you have interrupted the news with the news? So I did that. So I saw Donald Trump at some event. And I go, hey, Mr. Trump. I do an impression of you tonight on the show. And he goes, oh, you do great impressions. I go, yeah, but I'm doing you tonight on the show. I just want to let you know. And he turns around to his whole table and he goes, Jimmy Fallon's doing an impression of me tonight. I go, will you stop it? I'm trying to tell you something, man to man, so that you don't get caught off guard. I don't want you to be upset. I don't want to announce it to everybody. But I think he knows that, like, when I do an impression of people, I never kick anybody when they're down. I either kick them when they're up and they don't mind, or I don't hit them that hard. My jokes aren't that mean-spirited.
So you loved Saturday Night Live as a kid, right? And you used to do reenactments of the sketches in your home?
I was obsessed with the show. And this is back when VCRs just started to come out. A VCR, by the way, for anyone listening, is a video cassette recorder. I didn't even know what a VCR is. But we used to – so we had the VCR – and you have to press play and record to record the show. And I remember just like being obsessed with Saturday Night Live. And my parents would tape it, and they would watch it and just kind of cut out any sketches that were risque or dirty or things that we shouldn't see. And then the ones that were clean, we would be able to watch the sketches. Me and my sister Gloria, who was my only sister, it was just the two of us, and my mom and dad. And so we just got obsessed with the Czech brothers. We would say stuff that's risque that we had no idea was risque. Like, we would dress up in our parents' like 70s disco clothes and like walk around like, we are two wild and crazy guys, you know, and like we put on shows in front of our family and go like, we have to go to Statue of Liberty to get birth control devices. And my grandmother would like almost have a heart attack.
So how did you get to actually audition for Saturday Night Live?
I moved out to Los Angeles. I dropped out of college my senior year. My friend Peter Islin, I worked for a news weekly in Albany, New York called Metroland, and I was the secretary there. I used to answer the phones and stuff like that. And so he was leaving. He's becoming a manager in L.A., and I gave him my tape and resume and my headshot, which is awful. My first headshot, I'm wearing so much makeup, it's insane. I look like Tammy Faye Baker. So I gave him all the stuff, and he got out to L.A., and they called me, and they said, hey, we saw your tape. This girl, Randy Siegel, she's like, we'd love you to come out to L.A. and take acting classes and stuff like that. And I took classes in The Groundlings, which is like Second City, but the Los Angeles version. So I said, great. She goes, what do you want to do with your career? Do you have any goals? I'm like, I want to be on Saturday Night Live. And she was like, right. Okay, what else do you want to do? What really do you want to do? I was like, no, that's it. She goes like, yeah, it's just like one in a million chance that you get on Saturday Night Live. So, I mean, you should have another goal. And I'm like, that's all I really want to do. That's my goal. I mean, that was my goal since I was probably 14 or 15. If I ever blew out candles on a cake or wished upon a falling star or threw a coin in a well, I'd say I want to be on Saturday Night Live.
Fallon was on Saturday Night Live from 1998 to 2004. He co-anchored Weekend Update with Tina Fey. Becoming a cast member was his longtime dream, but when he finally got his audition, he blew it. Luckily, he was invited to come back and try again.
So I got to come back to Studio 8H and audition for Lorne Michaels on the on the stage where I've seen Richard Pryor do the monologue. I've seen Gilda Radner be funny. I've seen Steve Martin come out with the arrow through his head. You know, this is a legendary thing. So I figured if I don't get this job, it doesn't matter. This is an experience. I'll never forget this. So I go out and I do the celebrity impressions. Because that was my thing. I wanted to be like the next Dana Carvey. So I did all my impressions, and I get up to my last impression, and it's Adam Sandler. And at the time, no one did Adam Sandler. He was still on the cast. I think Billy Madison just came out or was about to come out. So I go, next up, Adam Sandler, and I go,
hey, how you doing? My mother used to take me all the time and to the walk of the audience, she would be like, and then I go, shut up,
you know. And I did this impression, and Lorne Michaels starts to laugh, and he puts his head in his hand, and he's laughing, and I go, wow, this is cool. Like, if nothing else happens, that happened, and the rest of the day was in slow motion for me. I was like walking on clouds, and it was like an episode of The Wonder Years. It was like a Wonder Years. It was like, what would you do? It's like, you know, me and Paul never talked again. You know, the whole Winnie Cooper was, I mean, it was like black. It was in sepia tone. It was like so Super 8. It was so great. I just, I got a Marcy, the first girl that came and told me what, she goes, that was one of the best auditions I've ever seen.
So once you got on Saturday Night Live, you wanted to be on it like all your life. You grew up wanting to be on it. You're finally on it. Was it hard to find a place for yourself? I've interviewed a lot of people who've been on Saturday Night Live, and most of them complain that in the first period it was really hard to get stuff written for them. It was hard to get on air. That it was hard to figure out who they were within this cast.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I first got on, I was the impressions guy. So I would just do impressions. So if they needed an impression, they would call me. So if they needed Robin Williams, I'd be like, oh, thank you. Yes, suddenly there's a guy going, no, thank you. Yes, oh, Mr. Happy's going, no. That's beautiful, yes. Oh, yes, suddenly 1, 2, 3, and bomb, kick, and chain, thank you. So, you know, I would do that. So I would be that guy. And then second season, I try to branch out. Of course, you know, everyone just gets in the way of themselves. I said, no more impressions. I want to do original characters. So I did like a guy who fixes your computer, like a IT guy at the office who's annoying. Because you know those guys always come in, they just make fun of you, and they fix your computer, but they make you feel like a fool. Because they're like, did you press X6, escape? And you go, no, I have no idea, you're the computer guy. The printer's now working. You know, you go, whatever, buddy. So I did him, and then I started...
You majored in computer sciences for a while, right?
Yeah, that was my major in college. I loved computer.
So were you that guy who'd say, did you press X6?
Kind of, but I was nicer to people. I was like, I could tell that if people didn't understand, I'd be like, oh, I'll fix it. But the thing that they always say, which is correct, they go, move so that you get out of the way and let them sit in your chair and fix it, which is kind of what I do. I go, can I just sit in your chair and I'll fix the whole thing? But but you see those people, they're so cocky, they're so proud, they're so big deal, you can fix my printer. I don't care. Don't make me feel like a jackass.
So you started doing characters.
So I started doing characters, and then Weekend Update happened. Colin Quinn was leaving Weekend Update, and Lorne said, Jimmy, I think you'd be great at doing Weekend Update. And I go, I don't think so. I don't really read the newspaper that much. I don't know much about the news. I'm the worst person for Weekend Update. Thank you so much. But no, thank you. I'd rather not do it. So they had auditions. So they had a bunch of people, the writers, a couple of writers were auditioning. One of the writers auditioning was Tina Fey. So she was just a writer at the time who wrote a lot of stuff for me. And she was super fun and super, super, super funny and super hardworking. And she had this sharp, sharp wit. I mean, almost too sharp for Weekend Update just to be by herself at the time. So I saw her audition and I was like, man, did you see Tina's audition? Was amazing. It was hilarious. She did this thing about Britney Spears. She did a thing about Britney Spears about how enjoy your body while you have it. Because one day you're going to lose it. She goes, one day, I mean, right now, look at your butt. Look at your butt. She goes, you have to look at that thing through a hole in a paper plate. Which I love that reference. That just made me laugh. So anyway, so I said to Lauren, I go, he goes, I really think you should still do it. Because Tina's not on the show. No one knows who she is. She's the head writer. I go, what about maybe me and Tina? And he's like, yeah, I'd like that. I would see what that's like. I like that idea. So he set up a test screening of me and Tina Fey and I in Conan O'Brien's studio over a weekend. And we did this like a test run of what our weekend update would be like. And he goes, Lauren said, I think it would be great because she's the smart one and you're the guy who forgot to do his homework and you need to cheat off her. That's the dynamic. Right. I go, great. And we got together and, man, it just clicked. It just worked. And I felt it. She felt it. I go, man, this is just so fun.
Tina Fey recently said on our show that when she started doing Weekend Update, it changed her life because that's the only position on Saturday Night Live where you look into the camera and you say your name. So everybody knows your name.
Yeah. Chevy Chase, I mean, he got famous off of one season.
Yeah, so did it change you to say, and I'm Jimmy Fallon?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, we were on a magazine cover. In that year, in that next year. I mean, it blew up. I mean, I couldn't have been more popular on the show. It was the best because then people start seeing your old stuff and they go, oh, yeah, yeah, he also does Barry Gibb and he does, you know, that's the guy that did, the Adam Sandler or the songs and, you know, so they start putting two and two together in a different way.
Right.
So, and you have to be kind of more of your sense of humor, you know, because I'm used to playing characters and other people, which really helped me, I think, for this talk show. Because when you host a talk show, as you know, you can't be phony. You have to be honest and you have to be yourself. It comes through. I mean, because eventually you go like, you know what? Somebody will come for a cooking segment on my show and they put mayonnaise and I go, ugh, I hate mayonnaise. Just that right there is like just being honest, saying like, whoa, you don't like mayonnaise. Like you're not Mr. I like everything. Like I hate mayonnaise. I think it's the most disgusting condiment that exists. But I can just say that because why not? That's who I am. And it's like, you know, I don't know.
So after years and years of wanting to be on Saturday Night Live, you're on it. You're a big success. You're hosting Update. And you leave after about 6 years.
Yeah. Well, the contract is 6 years. But I'm such a fan of John Belushi. I love John Belushi. And he was only on for 3 seasons. So in my head, I always said, I just want to do 3 seasons and leave.
Why did you want to leave? I mean, you wanted this all your life and you finally got it. Why did you want to get off of it eventually?
Because I've just heard so many horror stories about how people hate it and they hate each other and they get in fights and they get in arguments and they
what if
hate
they stay,
the show.
If they stay too long?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess I don't know what's the problem, but I didn't have that problem up to that point. So I go, I just want to leave now while everything's happy.
Uh-huh.
I'm friends with everybody. I mean,
was it
who
hard
knows?
When you left to then watch the show and not be on it?
Oh, that's where the drinking started. No. It was just depressing because, yeah, you watch and you go like, I miss all those guys because, gosh, you spend so much time in the office with these people and you sleep over. I mean, it's like, I mean, I've slept in my office. I don't know how many times at Saturday Night Live. You know, me and Horatio were office mates through the whole time. I miss him, you know, and I'd see these bits and I go, I do an impression of Howard Stern or I could have done that or, oh, man, that was a good joke. I wish I had told it, you know. You know, you're happy for everybody, but you're also jealous of everybody and you go, man. And then, you know, I don't know. It's a tough thing, but I think it was the right decision because I did stay friends with everybody, with Lauren and Tina. And I remember when I was leaving, Lauren said, so what are you going to do? I said, well, I'll try movies or something. I don't know. And he goes, would you ever think of maybe like hosting a talk show? I go, no, what do you mean? He's like, well, Conan O'Brien just signed this deal for like he's going to take over The Tonight Show with Jay Leno in 9 years. And I go, okay. Or in 5 years or some crazy amount.
I think it was 5 years.
Goes,
yeah.
Yeah. So I go, well, in 5 years, ask me again. But I don't know. Sure. And Tina, I remember Tina Fey was there and she goes, I think you'd be good at that because you got that Irish charm. You're always talking to everybody. I go, oh, whatever. I'm going to try movies now and we'll see what happens. So tried movies, had fun. I met my wife on one movie I made, Fever Pitch.
She was Drew Barrymore's producing partner.
Yeah, her name is Nancy Javonin, and she was just a cute girl on the set, and I was like, I just thought she was always nice. We didn't do anything on the set. We just were very professional. But then we were selling the movie in London, and I saw her again, and I go, oh, man, I miss hanging out with you. She goes, I miss hanging out with you too. I go, yeah, I like hanging out. She goes, I like hanging out with you. And then we kind of fell in love from there, and just like took it from there.
And so you got your show after Conan moved to the Tonight Show. And
yes.
Yeah.
Lauren said, what do you think? Would you like to do this? And I said, absolutely. I asked my wife. What do you think? Should I do this? She goes, of course. You're one of three people: David Letterman, Conan O'Brien, and then you. That's it. I mean, there's nobody else.
So now that you have a daily show or a nightly show, what do you no longer have time for in your life?
Anything.
Right.
Yeah. I have to schedule. If I want to do something, I have to schedule it in my day, because it's a packed day. So if I want to play video games, I have to schedule it and go, all right, I'm going to play video games from 8 o'clock to 8:30. But I can't do that because that's when I usually get to see my wife. So it's got to be after. My wife loves, I get home from work usually. I get into work probably around 10 o'clock, 10:30, and I get home probably around 9 o'clock earliest. Sometimes we do pre-tapes on the show of if we're spoofing Jersey Shore or we're making fun of, Lost, or, you know, we've done spoofs on all these things. So sometimes I get home at like midnight. But, you know, when I get home early, I like to hang out with my wife and we watch just awesome reality shows on TiVo, Real Housewives, all that stuff, Jersey Shore. We watch.
So you
all
really
that
watch?
Stuff.
I was wondering if you really watch Jersey Shore or if you just.
I love really, Jersey Shore.
Because you parody it on the show, yeah.
The reason why I love it is because I have nothing in common with these people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated. It's like watching National Geographic for me. I go, I want to see how they live in the wild. This is like, because like the situation will go by a club. You're like, nah, I don't want to go in there. There's not enough people in there. And I'm like, I'm the opposite. I'm like, there is too many people in that bar. I'm not going to go in that bar. I want to go to a place where no one is.
You were described in an article in Rolling Stone as the least tortured comedian imaginable. Would you agree with that description of yourself?
I think if I ever went to therapy, you'd find something. But yeah, I've had a pretty, I love my parents. I love my childhood. I love my sister. I get picked on like any kid would get picked on in school, but not that much. I mean, I got in some fights, but not that many fights. I think I had a pretty normal childhood. I mean, my life isn't Angela's Ashes. that guy. I mean, come on. I mean, they're eating a hard-boiled egg, you know. I had it easier than that. I didn't have it that bad.
So you went to Catholic school when you were young.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have
I wanted to be a priest.
Did you really?
Yeah. I loved it. I loved the church. I loved the idea of it. I loved the smell of the incense. I loved the feeling you get when you left church. I loved, like, how this priest can make people feel this good. I just thought it was – I loved the whole idea of it. My grandfather was very religious. So I used to go to Mass with him at, like, 6:45 in the morning, serve Mass, and then you made money, too, if you did weddings and funerals. They give you, you get like $5. And so I go, okay, I can make money, too. I go, this could be a good deal for me. I thought I had the calling.
Do you think part of that calling was really show business? Because like, the priest is the performer at church.
Yeah. I recently thought about this. Again, I've never been to therapy, but I guess that would be it's being on stage. It's my first experience on stage. It was as an altar boy. You're on stage next to the priest. I'm a co-star.
I'm also starring Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, I have no lines, but I ring bells. I ring bells and I swing the incense around. But it was and you are performing. You enter through a curtain. You exit through the. You're backstage. I mean, have you ever seen backstage behind an altar? It's kind of fascinating.
Right.
So I think it was. I think it was my first taste of show business. I think or acting or something.
And there are comparisons, I think, between a theater and a church. They're just kind of places that are separated from outside reality.
Yeah, and I remember I had a hard time keeping a straight face at church as well.
Did you?
Did you do
imitations of the priest?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I used to do Father McFadden all the time. He's the fastest talking priest ever. He'd be like, and then you leave and you go, "What was that? That guy's the best. I mean, that was church?" Sign me up. I'll do church. I'll do it 10 times a day if that's church. So he was great.
Do you still go to church?
I don't go. I tried to go back. When I was out in L.A. and I was like kind of struggling for a bit, I went to church for a while. But it's gotten gigantic now for me. It's like two. There's a band. There's a band there now, and you have to hold hands with people to the whole mass now, and I don't like doing that. You know, I mean, it used to be shaking hands peace was the only time you touched each other. Mm-hmm. Now I'm holding hands. Now I'm lifting people like Simba. I'm holding them. Hanya, hanya. I'm baptized. I'm doing too much. I don't want this frisbees being thrown, there's beach balls going around, people waving lighters. And I go, this is too much for me. I want the old way. I want to hang out with the, you know, the nuns. You know, that was my favorite type of mass, in the grotto. And just like straight up, that just mass.
I want to end with another clip of you doing an impression. And this is you doing Bob Dylan singing the theme from Charles in Charge, the old Tony Danza show. It's no, so
Scott,
much fun.
Scott Baio, actually.
Scott Baio?
Scott Baio was Charles.
Oh, I'm thinking it's the Tony Danza one.
Who's the boss? You're thinking who's the boss.
I'm thinking of who's the boss. You're right. I'm thinking who's the boss.
Yeah, exactly. But poor Tony Danza, by the way. He played Tony in every TV show he was on.
Right.
Can't you give him a different Italian name? Why does he always have to be Tony?
So why Charles in Charge? Why Dylan and Charles in Charge?
Well, it's almost the same thing as the Neil thing, is that I can do an impression of Bob Dylan, but we want to pick something that was fun and different. And we just thought that there was that one cadence of Charles in Charge of our days and our nights, Charles in Charge of our wrongs and our rights. There's the words to the theme song. And we were just laughing, me and this writer, Mike DiCenzo, and he was going like, Charles in Charge of our days and our nights. Of a wrongs and a rights, and it's like it kind of weirdly sounds like a Dylan thing. So so we did like a Dylan-esque version of that, where you have to play the harmonica is different than Neil Young's harmonica,
right,
whereas
right.
it's higher pitched and more screechy, and then it's like, and then when he gets to that weird, like he stops saying words at some point because he's like, I want child of me. I want a child of me, and it's almost like a Jello thing or something in his throat at just certain points of his singing. And I'm a huge fan, of course, of Bob Dylan. So the fact that we were able to pull this off, it came off pretty cool. I was happy with the end result.
Well, Jimmy Fallon, I think you're really incredible. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're the best. This was so much fun. I feel like I actually have inhaled fresh air.
Great. Thank you.
This is phenomenal.
Thank you so much. And Jimmy Fallon's new book is called Thank You Notes, and it's a collection of thank you notes from his regular hilarious Friday night feature. And here is Jimmy Fallon as Bob Dylan. Thank you again.
New boy in the neighborhood lives downstairs and is understood. He's just there to take good care of me, like he's one of the family. Charles in charge of our days and our nights. Charles in charge of our wrongs and our rights. Charles in charge of our days and our nights. Charles in charge of our wrongs and our rights. Now on Charles in charge.
Jimmy Fallon is the host of NBC's Late Night. We spoke last May after the publication of his book, Thank You Notes. If you want to see any of the sketches and impressions we talked about, you'll find links on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. This is Fresh Air. The new film Margin Call chronicles 24 hours in the life of a fictional investment firm on the eve of the financial crash of 2008. It stars Kevin Spacey, Zachary Quinto, and Jeremy Irons. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The timing is almost too good. A terrific Wall Street melodrama at the moment the Occupy Wall Street protests are building. We haven't seen the like since Three Mile Island had a near meltdown a couple of days after the China Syndrome exploded into theaters. Now, Margin Call seems anything but marginal. The movie opens with a chilling vision. Layoff specialists march onto a floor of a mighty New York financial firm and give various employees the bad news. Among them, risk management whiz Eric Dale, played by Stanley Tucci, a peerless character actor who signals more emotion by clenching and unclenching his jaw than performers who weep and moan. The boss on the floor is Sam Rogers, played by Kevin Spacey. Called on to give a pep talk, he emerges from his office, stone-faced, and tells his remaining employees to forget about their laid-off comrades. You guys, he says, survived the purge. You're the winners. These aren't sympathetic people, yet writer-director J.C. Chandor does build some sympathy. He frames the action as if this were a disaster picture like Earthquake or The Towering Inferno. At times, we find ourselves rooting for the firm's survival despite the fact that its executives are actively promoting worthless assets. Partly that's because we like Peter Sullivan, the risk management underling played by Zachary Quinto, who figures out what's coming and calls his half-drunk boss, played by Paul Bettany, who calls his boss, who calls his. We follow Sullivan, who's a former rocket scientist and the only person who can explain what's happening, up the corporate ladder a rung at a time, until he finally arrives at the big man, played by Jeremy Irons, who lands at 2 a.m. on the building's roof in a helicopter. What precisely is happening to the firm's finances? It's too Byzantine for most of the executives to figure out, let alone a movie critic. But to a person, they look at Sullivan's graph and are instantly spooked by the prospect of complete economic conflagration. They'll be left holding obviously toxic assets unless they act fast. Margin Call has a moral center of a sort. Spacey's Rogers turns out to be cold, but not sociopathic, and there's a line he's loath to cross. A fire sale of said assets dumped on unsuspecting customers, many of whom will go bust.
The real question is, who are we selling this to?
Same people we've been selling it to for the last 2 years, and whoever else will buy it.
But John, if you do this, you will kill the market for years. It's over. And you're selling something that you know has no value.
We are selling to willing buyers at the current fair market price so that we may survive.
You will never sell anything to any of those people ever again.
I understand.
Do you?
Do you? This is it. I'm telling you, this is it.
Spacey gives a major performance, his best in a decade, and Zachary Quinto, known mostly for being the new Mr. Spock, has a very un-Vulcan vulnerability. Simon Baker is deliciously repellent as the least shamefaced master of the universe, and Demi Moore, as the lone female top executive, underplays and gives the performance of her life. She's a woman who's given up everything to rise so high, and knows she'll be first in line to take the fall. Although Jeremy Irons is a little too Boris Karloff creepy for my taste, the tender way he drops the hammer on Demi will haunt my dreams for a long time. Margin Call is a different sort of big business film than its best-known predecessor, Oliver Stone's Wall Street. Stone wanted to create a capitalist demon in Gordon Gekko, but ended up making him so charismatic he became a role model. Despite the amounts of money bandied about, there's nothing in Margin Call to inspire anyone, except, of course, those fervent Wall Street occupiers.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see clips from Margin Call on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.